This tape was recorded live at the 1983 Sunstone Symposium, held in Salt Lake City, Utah. The name of the paper is The Mormon Integrity Crisis, Closet Doubters and Closet Fanatics, featuring Richard Cummings, Ph.D., Stanford University, Professor of Languages and Director of the Honors Program at the University of Utah. Responding to the paper is D. Jeff Burton, Master of Science, Environmental Health at the University of Michigan, and the author of The Phenomenon of the Closet Doubter. Let's go now to the session in progress.
Those who crowded about the doors of the temple, and on the other hand, there was the non-initiate to whom access to the temple was forbidden, the profane, from the Latin profanus, same root origin, literally he who stands in front of the temple, in other words, one who remains outside. He was considered alien to the sacred concerns of religion and was always regarded as a threat until he had been converted. His every action was considered as profanation, a disregard for the sacred arising from ignorance. It is noteworthy that fanaticism from the very beginning applied a strong we-they polarization, a dichotomy of the righteous and the unrighteous, which categorically excluded the possibility of any middle ground. Although the term fanatic originally had no pejorative connotation, it eventually came to be used by Christians to condemn the followers of pagan faiths, notably Muslims, and as Christianity became progressively more schismatic, Christians began applying it scathingly to some of their own number, but always in a highly selective manner. However, it was not until the 18th century that the notion of fanaticism emerged as a negative concept, at a time when society generally shifted from its emphasis on absolutism to tolerance. Gérard de Puymaige summarizes this development as follows, quote, "If fanatics abound and are often scorned in intolerant societies, the concept of fanaticism is not conceivable outside of tolerance, outside of pluralism. The fanatic's domain is the religio, within the framework of which he exercises his vocation as priest and his faith as a believer. He who fails to listen to the voice of the prophet spurns divine will," close quote. The French philosophe used the term fanaticism to condemn superstition, the various forms of irrational thinking and behavior, and above all, intolerance. The Encyclopédie, the French encyclopedia, in 1777, described fanaticism as a kind of disease. It is, quote, "a sickness of religion which affects the brain, a heavenly epilepsy, with such symptoms as dark melancholy, visions, and pseudo-prophecy." In the 19th and 20th centuries, the term fanaticism has been applied with increasing frequency to secular activities such as politics and science. But even then, it has strong religious overtones because it can only be applied to something which, for the fanatic, has taken on an aura of sacredness. Even the degeneration of the term fanatic into the fan of popular culture, and that's the origin of the term fan, has remained true to its origins. The fan identifies in a truly religious way with the idol, whether it be James Dean or the Beatles or whatever. Clearly, there can be no fanaticism without some form of religious faith. To further refine our insights into fanaticism, I would like to quote a few pithy descriptions of fanaticism from the most perceptive study of the subject to appear to date, namely, Fanaticism, a Historical and Psychoanalytical Study by Enal, Molnar, and de Puymaige. I invite you to consider their applicability to Mormonism, bearing in mind that they were not written with Mormonism in mind. Quote, "One thing is constant in fanaticism, and that is that the object to which the fanatic devotes his jealous, vindictive, and monomaniacal faith must acquire in his eyes an exclusively sacred character. Faith in the leader or the family leads to fanaticism by virtue of the exclusivity and the unique saving function it invests in its object." And continuing the quotation, "In his illusion of having found the absolute and superhuman, the fanatic believes himself to be in possession of the truth, which confers upon him omniscience, omnipotence, and invulnerability, all superhuman conditions. The feeling of omnipotence is accompanied by a narcissistic thrill at the idea of being among the elect of God or history. The paranoid dichotomic system, true-false, black-white, friend-enemy, engenders radicalization of thought channeling aggression toward an enemy. The fanatic cannot tolerate scientific thought. The criteria which fanaticism entails are, I'm still quoting, exclusivity, intolerance, the search for an absolute, the conviction of being right, imperviousness to any line of reasoning that seeks to deflect it from its course. And continuing, faith, while not in itself implying fanaticism, does remain its matrix. The zeal that faith induces carries fanaticism within it, unleashing it as soon as it becomes excessive or exclusive. Continuing, fanaticism is also characterized by knowledge of good and evil as absolutes, a binary and standardizing way of thinking, an aversion to anything that opposes the truth or questions it, however slightly. Fanaticism, through all these forms, pursues the same goal, perfection and harmony on earth or in the other world. Close quote. It would be a simple matter to cull passages from recent addresses of various general authorities, especially concerning church history, the women's movement, the authority of the living prophet, and the theory of evolution, which would exemplify, point for point, the foregoing catalog of identifying characteristics of fanaticism. But I will spare you that exercise, which would be as unnecessary as it would be ungracious for my present purpose, all the more so because it is not always possible to distinguish between deliberate fanaticism and rhetorical overstatement. The real danger lies in what de Puymaige calls the fanaticizer-fanaticized dialectic, according to which even a hint of fanaticism in the pronouncements of top-level leaders can be dangerously magnified by what de Puymaige uncharitably calls fanatical henchmen at lower hierarchical levels. As I have already suggested, the words fanatic and fanaticism rarely occur in Mormon discourse. For that reason, it is significant and ironical that Elder Bruce R. McConkie has included an entry on fanaticism in his Mormon Doctrine, in which he states, and I quote, "Fanaticism is the devil's substitute for and perversion of true zeal. It is exhibited in wildly extravagant and overzealous views and acts. It is based either on unreasoning devotion to a cause, a devotion which closes the door to investigation and dispassionate study, or on an overemphasis on some particular doctrine and practice, an emphasis which twists the truth as a whole out of perspective." He concludes his comments with an italicized reminder that stable and sound persons are never fanatics. They do not ride gospel hobbies, close quote. In view of Elder McConkie's vigorous definition of fanaticism and such categorical pronouncements as his June 1980 address on the seven deadly heresies, there is a certain amount of irony in his condemning overzealous views and acts, unreasoning devotion to a cause, and overemphasis on some particular doctrine or practice which twists the truth out of proportion. Indeed, the oratorical overkill typical of fanaticizers raises a very serious question about religious fanatics in general. Why so much vehemence in setting forth presumably self-evident points of doctrine? To paraphrase Shakespeare, the fanatic doth protest too much. And one cannot help but ask if this is not a form of overcompensation for some sense of inadequacy or fear. In an early article in Dialogue, a landmark statement on the challenge of honesty, Frances Lee Menlove summarized this problem brilliantly when she observed, and I quote, "Behind the mask of fanatical preservation may be the real fear that the truth of the church is too fragile to tamper with, that an honest and open examination may destroy one's faith or way of life. Thus, the religious conservative may also be hiding from himself a basic lack of faith." Close quote. Joseph Rudin makes a similar observation when he asks, quote, "Does fanaticism originate as compensation for one's own inner security? As Jung emphasizes, fanaticism is the brother of doubt." And he adds that the psychotherapist probably meets fanaticism most frequently in the form of perfectionism and ethical rigorism. Close quote. Einar provides additional useful insights into the deleterious effects of compensatory fanaticism when he notes that, quote, "Fanaticism always implies a betrayal of self, which is manifested by an inner anguish deep, gnawing guilt feelings which cannot be shaken despite attempts to camouflage them through loud protestations and tireless activity. And he refers to the accompanying compromise of integrity, characterizing the defensive elimination of moral conscience and the replacement of ideals by satisfaction of a narcissistic order, power, opportunism, vengeance, ambition, etc. Close quote. The point I wish to emphasize here is that since doubt, however much denied or resisted, is so patently a major component of fanaticism, the closet doubter, closet fanatic syndrome is not so much a polarization of opposites as it is simply two sides of a coin. It should be clear by now that since fanatics seem to use their fanaticism to protect themselves from their own doubts, as well as to denounce the doubts of others, the true meaning of the term closet fanatic is to be found in the fanatic's instinctive effort to keep his own doubts safely locked away in the closet of his unconscious mind. Furthermore, the closet fanatic constitutes a very real and present danger, much more so than the closet doubter, because he is less conscious of the root of his fanaticism than the doubter is of his doubt. And he wreaks ungodly havoc in the name of God. It should be apparent then that fanaticism poses as holiness, but is actually a form of hubris. Reinhold Niebuhr observed that, quote, the tendency to claim God as an ally for our partisan ends is the source of all religious fanaticism, close quote. Indeed, to gratify one's own power needs, to engage in virulent self-righteousness in the name of the Lord, is to be guilty of a particularly insidious form of blasphemy. It is a contradiction of Christ's admonition to love our neighbors ourselves, and it is condemning the mote in our neighbor's eye without seeing the beam in our own. Practically speaking, there is a synergistic relationship between the closet doubter and the closet fanatic. Whether externally perceived or internally sensed, doubt fires the fanatic's fanaticism, and the fanatic's heightened zeal drives the doubter farther into the closet. I am convinced that the only way to break this vicious circle is to bring doubt, not just the doubter, to bring doubt, and with it, fanaticism, out of the closet. All too often, doubt and religious faith seem to be antithetical, and accordingly, doubt has come in for its full share of condemnation. At a time when the church was very much on the defensive, Brigham Young warned that, quote, if you allow yourselves to doubt anything that God has revealed, it will not be long before you find fault with the authorities of the church, close quote. Bruce R. McConkie states, quite simply, that faith and belief are of God. Doubt and skepticism are of the devil, and he adds that doubt comes from failure to keep the commandments, close quote. On the other hand, John A. Widsoe made some subtle distinctions that gave doubt a more positive emphasis. And again I quote, doubt, unless transmuted into inquiry, has no value or worth in the world. Doubt of the right kind, that is, honest questioning, can lead to faith, close quote. To claim never to have experienced doubt in religious matters, or to call all doubt sinful, is to deny a central fact of human experience, and to ignore the very real doubts of some pivotal religious leaders. As Francis Lee Menlove points out, and again I quote, no one should doubt that in some way or for some reason he is also a doubter, close quote. Let's not forget that Jesus Christ himself expressed acute doubt when agonizing on the cross he cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Joseph Smith began his religious career by doubting that any existing church had the truth. And during his prayer in the grove, he experienced a moment of intense darkness and doubt before the enlightenment of the first vision burst upon him. And doubt assailed him repeatedly throughout his career as prophet. J. Reuben Clark developed a rock-like testimony only after wrestling with central religious issues concerning which he had doubts, leading him to note that if we have truth, it cannot be harmed by investigation. If we have not truth, it ought to be harmed. Not only is it evident from the foregoing examples and from countless others I could cite that doubt can be respectable and positive, but it is also unavoidable if the gospel is to be subjected to the unhampered scrutiny of thought which it needs and deserves. I would even assert that as free agents emulating that divine intelligence which we have been told is God's true glory, it is our God-given duty to doubt wherever honest inquiry requires it, and to transcend that doubt in developing a valid testimony based on our own deepest experience and our own hard-won convictions. A so-called testimony based on blind obedience, blend conformism and the desire to look good expressed in various forms of mindless activism simply is not a testimony in the best sense of the word. It is a sad compromise, a convenient, undernourished, and less than inspired embryo of a testimony which no one should settle for in an institution with the all-embracing truth claims of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which promises its faithful members nothing less than the splendor and magnanimity of true godhood. As Parlier Christensen, the late beloved and outspoken professor of English at Brigham Young University, observed, and I quote, "God himself is limited when men cease to think." He also affirmed that, quote, "true religion removes conflicts everywhere. It puts man at peace with himself and other men. It gives him inner integrity and outer compassion. There is something wrong with a religion that puts head and heart, mind and emotion, knowledge and faith at odds with one another. Religion is not doing what it is supposed to do if it fails to draw people of all faiths together in mutual respect and sympathy." Close quote. It may not be realistic to expect the church to achieve such a broad ecumenical ideal. It would be nice, but it may not be realistic. But surely the church is big enough and generous enough to pursue the kind of internal ecumenicalism that would bring together such diverse factions as what I've referred to as closet doubters, closet fanatics. Through an honest confrontation and compassionate discussion of their respective doubts, fears, and expectations. After all, the word integrity derives from the Latin word for wholeness, and it has come to connote probity, completeness, and unity. The church cannot be whole and complete without making room for its thinkers and doubters as well as its true believers. It cannot achieve probity unless it deals forthrightly and compassionately with those core doubts which have generated the factionalism so painfully evident in the church to anyone who looks beneath the surface. A disclaimer seems to be in order at this point, since anyone presumptuous enough to discuss integrity as broadly as I have today can all too easily be accused of trying to pass himself off as a model of integrity. I make no such claim, although I admire integrity whenever I see it because I know how difficult it is to achieve and maintain. Consequently, I can think of no more fitting way to end this paper than by quoting a dear friend and colleague, Dr. Lowell Bunyan, a man of the highest integrity who has used doubt and discouragement as stepping stones to Christ-like greatness. Quote, "One ought not, in the words of Levi Edgar Young, to pulverize the gospel. Live it piecemeal, one rule or principle at a time, bolstered by a single text. It is more prudent to keep in mind the gospel as a whole. For example, Latter-day Saints believe in the fatherhood, justice, love, and intelligence of God. Everything that men have said and done in the name of God cannot be accepted at face value unless it is consistent with his character and purpose. And for me, Jesus Christ best reveals the character, spirit, and will of God. What I cannot square with Christ's teachings, I will question no matter what the source. The nature of God becomes then a basic rational guide with which to interpret the religious and moral life. This, in my judgment, is the most significant purpose of theologizing." Thank you.
Did you notice the flowers as you came down Main Street today? There's a beautiful garden out here to our north. Church has done a beautiful job in preparing it, and it's a profusion of flowers and water. And even I was walking through there today, I even noticed a few weeds that have escaped the groundsman's hoe. What I'd like to do is tell you first what I think about Richard Cummings' paper, and then what I feel about it, and then what I believe we ought to do about it. The thought that came to my mind as I heard the paper and as I read it earlier were these kind of thoughts: well thought out, interesting, scholarly, provocative, zealous but not fanatical. And somewhat complete. Basically, I can't disagree that it may be possible for doubt-driven fanatics to exist in the church. There are a few things that I disagree with in the paper, but they're not important. How do I feel about the paper? Well, as I search my innards, I sense the mixed emotions of hope and melancholy and some sadness and some encouragement and some disappointment. As you know, our emotions are like our beliefs. They're essentially involuntary. We can suppress them, or ignore them, but it's easier to investigate rather than to deny them. The hopefulness comes because Richard's purpose was to call attention to the problems of doubt and to help us see ourselves more objectively. These are the same objectives that I had last year for the Closet Doubter piece. The sadness and disappointment comes because I think we're likely to fail, or any of those outside this room. If I have a problem with the paper, it's because it seems a bit narrow, maybe a bit too correct, a bit too scholarly, a little flat, maybe a little too dimensional. It seems to need, for me anyway, some more reference to the real people of the church. The Mormonism is millions of real people. The Mormon church is the people. It's their hopes, beliefs, ambitions, fears, doubts, loves, and anger. The one person that's mentioned in the paper as a possible doubt-driven hidden fanatic or closet fanatic is Bruce R. McConkie, and I guess I wasn't convinced that he is such. In fact, I guess as I think about it, I can't even think of one person who fits the description. Not to say that I wasn't moved by the paper. The anguish, the frustrations, the sorrow, the compassion and the integrity of one person shines through like the sunlight out of the clouds, and that's Richard Cummings himself. Strong words like covert inquisition and mercifully abated and ominous and insidious from a scholar like Richard betray a personal involvement here. To me, Richard's heart was torn open and its contents spilled all over the pages of this document. I know something about it because everyone who has read or heard the Closet Doubter paper has suspected that I was a doubter too. In that paper, I asked others to share their beliefs and feelings and experiences, and some have responded, and even the church has responded, I think. And we're sure to hear a lot about it here at the symposium. I thought you might be interested in just hearing a few comments from some of the letters that I've received. I hope I have time to maybe read a few paragraphs. This from an elder out of state. My wife, my four children, and I have come through the most personally disruptive period these past 5 years. We have slowly come full circle from believing members of the church who practiced their belief to only one small step away from being new members. With the subsequent onset of disbelief, as we sought help at various levels within the church, we were continually rebuffed and told that the problem lay not in what we had discovered, but in the fact that we were voicing our discoveries. What we needed to do, we were assured, was to go home and pray more sincerely. Having both come from a tradition that insisted that Mormonism was true in the absolute, and having never before been seriously challenged as to the basis of this tradition, not prepared for the things that our studies revealed to us, nor were we prepared for the incapacity on the parts of most of those within the church whom we approached for help when we presented the concerns we had come up with. We enjoy a real love-hate relationship with Mormonism. We love it when we remember the fun times and the good things we had from it in our youthful years. And we hate it for its deceptiveness and now its apparent basis of untruth and half-truth. We love it because it is still like a mother to us in the imagery of our minds. And we hate it because our mother has been revealed the whore. Pretty strong words. This from a high priest. I am a physician, a high priest, and have been extremely active in the affairs of the church in numerous ways. I have gone through exactly the processes you have described, including having to be extremely careful that the things I say are both true according to my belief and non-destructive to the faith of the good people of the church that I care about and fully believe. This has become increasingly difficult because in addition to the basic fundamental tenets you have listed which posit doubters reject, I add a few more too, including what I feel is a hierarchical priesthood system that negates most of what the church teaches about the worth of all persons. I have therefore recently been refusing to utilize the power that comes from the ordination and have withdrawn from priesthood functioning to accepting only those assignments that can also be performed by unordained persons. In doing so, in some circles, I have actually come out of the closet, but only part way. I wonder who those unordained persons are. And then a few paragraphs from a very emotional letter that was printed in the Sunstone, and you probably heard it, but let me just hit a couple of paragraphs. I think I've come through the transition state that is described, though I'm not as tranquil as some seem to be. I do remember feeling almost immediately and spontaneously a heavy, heavy load moving off of me as I suddenly realized that I could decide whether or not I would do what church leaders asked me to do. And I did have the choice of what I believed. Something seemingly so obvious, one wonders how we become so buried in guilt, fear, the idea of duty, that freedom eludes us. At any rate, I remain active, though I am always holding back emotionally now. I have a headache and have for years at the end of almost every Sunday. Of course, staying active seems the best thing to do. It would be unfair of me to jar my family, to which I still feel an extremely strong commitment. However, because of this commitment, I sometimes wonder if my hypocrisy, for that is what it is, and my lack of courage, again, that is what it is, will not in the long run be evident and do more harm to my children than truthfully stating and acting on my disbelief. What are the effects of the subtle dishonesty on oneself and those close to one? Are my Sunday headaches an indication of how my body is reacting to it? And then, of course, shortly after the article appeared in Sunstone, maybe 6 or 8 weeks later, an article appeared, two editorials in the church section, one called Who Are the Doubters and Be Ye Believing, basically stating that I'm sure you read it, but for example, it says, it seems from the scripture that receiving a commandment with doubt in our hearts and obeying it with slothfulness virtually puts us in the same class as those who obey not at all. Instead of being critical of the church, we should believe it, accept it, then apply it in our lives. There is no room for skepticism. There is a great need for belief and acceptance. In the day of the Lord's mortal ministry, the believers followed him and the unbelievers crucified him. Shall we be the true believers today, or shall we choose the ways of the world? And then even in the priesthood bulletin of May 1983 came this statement: every Latter-day Saint has a responsibility to know for himself or herself with a certainty beyond doubt that Jesus is the resurrected living Son of the living God. So we've had response. I wish we'd had more. I encourage you all to make your thoughts and experiences known. But in all these writings and in Cummings' paper this morning, the words dishonesty and hypocrisy are used as if, in fact, those two terms apply to all closet doubters. I intended no such meaning. My intention was closet doubters have feelings of guilt, dishonesty, and hypocrisy. Having feelings and, in fact, being guilty, being dishonest, and being a hypocrite are two different things. And this is a real source of sorrow for me, because it hurts people. This attitude can't help but drive the questioners and thinkers deeper into the closet. But I don't think the church or anyone else intends to push people into the closet. I don't think there's an intentional an institutional intention to hurt, and I don't think that it's fanaticism. Perhaps there's some degree of it. But I think basically it's kind of like poor technique. It's basically a mistake, a misinterpretation of what's going on, and maybe even just a simple confusion of the terms. The original title of my paper, The Closet Doubter, was The Phenomenon of the Faithful Doubter. For various reasons, I changed it to The Closet Doubter, mainly for dramatic effect, much to my regret today. Faithful doubter sounds like a dichotomy. It's like saying a fat, thin man, or a happy, sad person, or an evil saint. Can a person be a faithful doubter? Yes, if we understand the context and meaning of the terms faith and belief, doubt and distrust, as I would like them to have been used, and as Richard so ably described at the end of his paper. I think I blew it last year, and I accept the responsibility of not being clear, but I'd like to make it a little straighter now. As a scientist, I think of belief and faith in terms of the sensory evidence, the observations, the statistics, the reproducibility, the levels of confidence, the intellect, and questioning. I don't think of belief in terms of feelings, in terms of good or evil, in terms of supernatural or religious, only in terms of what is in an objective sense. Belief is involuntary. It is what we actually think when we're honest with ourselves. And belief and faith, I think, should be considered to be more mutually exclusive than we use these terms. I think of faith as associated with religion, as our feelings, as personal, as subjective, as a function of inspiration, and as a gift from God. The opposite of faith is a rejection of God and a rejection of the gospel and distrust, not doubt, as Richard suggested. When God answers the prayers of Moroni 10:4, I think he responds with a gift of faith, not by giving evidence. This is a complex subject, and I must admit that I have written a paper which I've submitted to Dialogue, and it's in a review process now. Hope it will be printed. What I'm saying is that I could probably agree with the church editorials if the word doubt was changed to distrust or unfaithfulness, and if the word belief was changed to faith. Then it makes perfect sense to me. Let me give you some examples of how this works, and my time is getting by, but Richard mentioned the essay by Francis Lee Menlove in Dialogue. In fact, it's in the very first Dialogue that was ever issued back in 1966. And it's one of the most beautiful, insightful, moving of all Mormon writings, I think. It deals with honesty and concern and care and love and people. And she suggests that all of us are subject to uncertainties and doubt. That it's a natural part of our life, a part of the growing process, and part of testimony building. I'd like you to consider for a second the challenge and burden placed upon the thinking Mormon, particularly those of you who don't know how those of us who doubt could do it. The burdens of belief and faith encompass all that other Christians are expected to accept plus more. Let me read you 5 religious claims. See how easy or hard it is for you to accept each claim, and try to analyze your response on 2 levels, the intellectual belief level that I've been talking about and the emotional faith level also. The first one is, there is a God. Jesus is our Savior. It is best to honor our parents. The Book of Mormon is a history of ancient Americans. Adam on Diamond is the place of the Garden of Eden. All of those are claims made for and by the church, and we are expected to build a testimony and to know that these things are true. In the first two claims, and mostly in the third, there's no objective, reproducible sensory evidence to support or deny the claims. The evidence to support the claim must be of necessity based upon our own personal experience, the weight of the claiming authority, and your own individual interpretation of subjective evidence. Obviously, here, faith plays a very big role. In the last two claims, the same rules apply, except that evidence certainly abounds to either support or deny the truthfulness of those two claims about the Book of Mormon and Adam on Diama. On a strictly intellectual level, I don't think many could accept the Book of Mormon. So again, here, faith is the key, at least for thinking Mormons. Faith and hope. Getting back to Richard's paper and what I think we ought to do about it, specifically I'd like to ask, how can we call attention to the problem of doubt? How could we be more objective about our own doubts? And how do we spread the good news that intellectual questioning and doubting isn't sin, and it isn't slothfulness? The church isn't likely to come and ask Richard or me for permission to reprint our essays in the church news. So if you'll forgive a personal reference, let me share my own experience. Basically, on an objective, intellectual, sensory level, I think the claims for Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon are questionable. They're improbable. They're incredulous. They're unbelievable. They're doubtful. But on a faith level, I sense that what we are doing is right. There's truth somehow here in God's eternal scheme of things. We're involved in a good cause. And my heart and soul have been instructed to stick it out. So my suggestion is to you that you and I must carry these messages out. We can't wait for the editorial writer of the church news to understand. And we can't wait for the fanatics to get their psychiatric help and repent. We ought to follow the courage shown by Sunstone Dialogue, J.D. Williams, and Sterling McMurrin, and let our true beliefs and feelings be known. And I think we can do it successfully if we are clear and precise in our usage of the critical terms faith and belief, doubt and distrust. In my stake, I'm a high councilman working in the social service area. I seem to have survived despite my lack of knowing. And yes, I walk a tightrope in my stake. But I've been giving a talk in the wards whose theme is, "It's okay to say I don't know." The talk has been met with mixed reviews, but no one sleeps, and the stake president hasn't asked me to stop. The point is, I think, that it is possible to be a faithful doubter. So I'd like to suggest to you that if you're struggling with this problem, I think you can go back to your wards and come out of the closet, but do it in a loving, faithful, non-destructive way. Be honest but tactful. Question, but avoid hurting people. Don't destroy others' fragile faith. Reach out, understand, and encourage. I know that each person's situation is different, and that our ability to be heard without being hurt is an individual thing, and some of you can and some of you can't. But I'd like to suggest that we not just be scholarly listeners. Let's take the responsibility of Richard's worthy objective of calling attention to this problem. Thank you.